change worldwide at FordFoundation.org.
If you're having a hard time selling that old car or truck or just don't want the bother of selling it, the WLRN Vehicle Donation Program can help. Just call 877-WLRN-CAR, 877-957-6227, or donate online at WLRN.org. Donating is easy when the tow truck comes to your home and picks up the vehicle. They give you the paperwork that you'll need and relieve the stress of what to do with the old car that just won't sell. That's 877-WLRN-CAR or donate online at WLRN.org.
And we return. It is today's Topical Current, 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. Joseph Cooper here with you today. Bonnie Berman is off. This hour we begin with attorney Howard Talenfeld. He's the founding president of Florida's Children First. It's a nonprofit legal service organization which was organized some 12 years ago. He joins us now by phone from Plantation. Welcome to you, Mr. Talenfeld. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Could you speak up a little bit, Howard?
Sure.
Very good. Also with us is the interim regional managing director of the Department of Children and Families, Southern Region. She's Gilda Ferradas. Did I pronounce that incorrectly?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Ferradas.
Yes.
Okay. Gilda Ferradas was appointed in July. She's served more than 35 years at DCF and also predecessor agencies. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Gilda Ferradas, why does it seem so many incidents have occurred recently with DCF and children and some real tragedies?
Well, that's an answer that we're all looking for. If you've been following some of the things that have taken place since some of those tragedies have occurred, our new interim secretary, Secretary Jacobo, upon taking office, immediately put in a number of steps to try and find out just that, one of which was to do a review of all the recent child deaths. And another very important thing that we're doing, I think, is bringing in national experts. So it's not only internally departments.
So you're an interim regional managing director. Whoops. Who do we have there?
Newsroom.
Hi. Are you still with us, Ms. Ferradas?
Yes. Yes, I am. I don't know what happened.
So you're an interim regional managing director for the Southern Region. And you were hired by the interim director of DCF. Does that point to staffing difficulties and poor choices?
I'm not getting your question. I was with the department before. She was appointed acting interim secretary.
I see.
So I was just appointed interim during this period in this position. So I was with the department before.
Okay, but you've been in this business many, many years, 35 years or so.
Correct, in different areas of the department, not all.
Attorney Howard Talenfeld, tell us more about Florida Children's First, how it's set up and what it does, and what are some of its achievements?
We are a statewide group of child advocates. We have persons from all over the state of Florida that are working oftentimes with DCF at trying to improve the child welfare system. We also have done a lot of work legislatively with them, so we have been responsible for much of the independent living legislation that has extended foster care to 21, the educational legislation that has allowed foster children to stay in their home schools, even though they're moved to families, you know, in different locations, getting them registered quickly for school. You've worked on appropriations and protecting the appropriations of DCF as well when the legislature has looked for places and balancing the budget of the state of Florida at the backs of children. And so we are there fighting for representation of kids. Recently, we were able to obtain lawyers to represent these fragile, medically impaired children with breathing difficulties when they are brought into care and oftentimes could be in a position where they're institutionalized. So that's just a few.
So you're not necessarily adversarial towards the Department of Children's and Family?
Well, there are times where we're asking them to do the things we're hoping that they would want us to be asking them, but they can't because the legislature or for other political reasons, they can't. sometimes
I think it would be fair to say that we all, we both have the best interests of the children at heart.
And I have to agree.
Gilda Ferradas, tell me, what makes a good DCF caseworker? And with staff layoffs and cutbacks, are they overwhelmed, and maybe that's why children slip through cracks?
Well, we have not had any staff layoffs or cuts. As a matter of fact, last year we increased the number of child protective investigators that we have statewide. We've also been able to add a pool of trainees so that we would have investigators in training, so as vacancies come up, there are other the hiring timeline is not as long. So we have actually had an increase in the staffing. But that said, it's still a challenging job. I think everyone would agree that it's a very challenging job. And we are constantly juggling caseloads to make sure that we're balancing our investigators' caseload as best as possible.
Well, surely no one would want to be a caseworker for children and be swamped with cases who doesn't have at heart the best interest of the children and, in fact, enjoy being around children.
I think that's correct. I think the staff that work with us, both in the department and in our partner agencies, it's a calling for them, and it's something that they want to do. They realize it's hard work and not the best paying job in the world, and they have a calling for this, and they care deeply about the children.
Ms. Director, explain how Florida CBC, or community-based care, differs from previous models.
Well,
and could that be part of the problem, that there's so much outsourcing?
I don't think that that's part of the problem. The reason that the outsourcing happened was because the legislator and the governor at the time thought that we needed the services more community-based, as the name implies, where instead of it being a big department making some of taking care of these children, it's more of a community effort. So the community-based care agencies are private agencies, so they are not bogged down by some of the bureaucracy in our state system. But in addition, they're community-based, and they are. They have history for most part in the communities that they serve, and they know their community and are able to partner with other agencies in the community to serve the children.
Howard Tallenfeld, community-based care and more local input under the care of DCF children sounds good on the surface, but is it actually make the services vary according to local competency?
Well, I can tell you that there are some improvements with the concept of getting community organizations involved that really do understand the locality. But the other side of it, in some communities, there's a huge amount of splintering of the child welfare system and a lack of communication and the ability to understand whether or not some of these agencies are performing at the levels they're supposed to. So, for an example, 3 years ago, 76 positions were cut by DCF. They may have ultimately hired back some more investigators, but these were quality assurance positions. These were folks in central office that were overseeing the program, because with privatization, DCF became primarily a contract matter, except for when it investigates child abuse and neglect in Dade County. And so what they did was they hired Our Kids, for an example. Well, Our Kids is another organization that came into existence, but they're primarily a contract manager as well. And then they've gone out and they've brought in various case management agencies that are actually the ones that are providing case management services to the kids. One of the things we're seeing is that when DCF cut those positions, they no longer were able to look at the performance of the community-based partners in quite the same way. So 3 or 4 years ago, we were looking at quality assurance data that showed that Our Kids was missing doing important things like assessing the needs of the children, looking at risk assessments as frequently as they needed, 20% of the time. And then when, you know, these positions got cut, DCF lost some of their eyes and their ears to understand what was happening in the community. And we've seen some very strong indicators, like a series of deaths, 20 deaths in a very short period of time. 4 or 5 months that are bad indicators. And frankly, we're concerned that DCF doesn't know exactly the quality of what is happening and whether the information sharing, you know, the red flags in these deaths are concerning. But we also know that there's problems with kids being sexually abused in the system, with child-on-child sexual abuse. So privatization has had a mixed bag of results when, unfortunately, you know, it's tough to get one government agency to do the job, but you get 4 or 5 private agencies handling the same child. Sometimes mistakes are made. Kids slip through the cracks.
Gilda Ferradas, would you like to answer that?
Yes, I agree for the most part with Mr. Talenfeld. Yes, there was a reduction in the quality assurance positions. And I know that this is something that our new interim secretary is looking at. We are already looking internally at our protective investigations piece of the quality assurance and looking to do some real-time case reviews so that the case reviews don't happen, you know, months or years after a case is closed, but that we're trying to see how we can embed into our system some real-time case review on open cases so there's more eyes on the open cases while they're being worked. There is also the issue that Mr. Talenfeld talked about, the QA on the other side, on the community-based care side, and that is something that we will be looking at.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with a comment or question, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-WLRN. 1-800-743-9576. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Howard Talenfeld, how does guardian ad litem aid in the kids' services?
Well, the guardian ad litem.
Could it be depended on more?
Well, I can tell you that, ironically, I think the guardian ad litem program does a very good job in attracting lay volunteers and giving them some form of training.
Explain what it does.
The guardian ad litem comes into a case involving a child, a dependency case, and they are a party to the case, and their job is to interview the children and the various parents and the DCF folks and to understand what's happening in the life of the child and are the kids at risk or should they be returned home. They make recommendations to the court, the juvenile judge, who ultimately decides these cases. And so to the extent that there are guardian ad litem, because we don't have 100% of our cases and kids staffed with them, they are a very important improvement to the system. The other side of it is that in many cases that are very difficult, kids stuck in the system for 3 or 4 years, the medically fragile kids I just suggested, developmentally disabled kids, they get stuck in the system, and some of them are sometimes harmed. And you need a little more. You might need, in some cases, a trained lawyer to assist. And so, for example, this session, the legislature agreed with us on this for purposes of trying to, you know, bring in counsel for the medically fragile children as well. We want to strengthen this program. We want them to be able to hire outside lawyers for the most difficult cases to help these kids. So it's a valuable, important part of our system.
Howard Talenfeld, you've been involved in this for decades. What would be the first step that you would take to streamline these DCF policies and make these kids safer?
All right. The first step I would take right now, and I believe that Interim Secretary Jacobo, is in the right place. She's once again made the system transparent. We were having a tough time getting information the last 3 years with the prior secretary. And in making it transparent and making this a community discussion with the advocates and the providers and DCF, we can identify what the problems are. We don't have to depend upon a Miami Herald reporter to, you know, catch 20 deaths in a short period of time where there were lots of red flags to see the problems. We were at that point 3 years ago. Secretary Jacobo was working directly, you know, with the secretary at the time, George Sheldon, and we were trying to work on improving the problems we were facing. We were looking at the data together. We saw, for an example, some of our private agencies weren't doing so well, you know, on these quality assurance reviews, that lots of kids weren't getting the services they were supposed to be getting, the assessments, the risk assessments, to understand what their needs were. And at that point, the department had eyes and ears, and was struggling to try to get the lead agencies to do better jobs with respect to, you know, ultimately making sure kids are returned home safely or kids have permanent placements.
And Ms. Ferraraz, you can answer that if you'd like.
Yes, I agree with Mr. Tauenfeld. This is the items that he has enumerated are definitely Interim Secretary Jacobo's priorities, and she definitely sees the solution as being a community solution and not just a department solution, and that's why she has brought in so many partners and even national experts to come into Florida and look at our systems, look at our cases, and together come up with solutions.
I could interject. There are a few other things that I think are really important for the department to look at right now. One of those things is that the department, you know, we faced a death, you know, several years ago with Gabriel Myers, who, you know, passed away, a young man in Broward who hung himself and had been sexually abused. And the department studied that case very hard, made a series of recommendations. They put together a Gabriel Myers work group on child sex abuse. They found that this is a prevalent problem in the state of Florida amongst foster care. Sexual abuse is a very big problem. And yet they were able to make a series of recommendations, and unfortunately, 3 years ago, with changes of administration, the recommendations and the ability to try to address this problem were abandoned. None of these recommendations were implemented. We're hoping and we believe that Secretary Jacobo is going to get back on that track, too, to try to help improve the system. One of the problems we've seen is that, you know, with investigations, there is a 60-day limit, and then all of a sudden the investigator, the protective investigator, is out of the case. They're gone. And, you know, they may find that there's a high-risk case and just let the case close, or they may find there's medium risk. We believe that there needs to be communication. First of all, the ability to extend, you know, in high-risk cases, the ability for the department to continue to monitor and look at the child, you know, the family that's at risk with a child at risk beyond that 60-day period. Don't close a file, but bring in protective services, get the community services involved, get the lead agency involved, sending case management out with a case plan, and have the ability to go to court. That may be something that we may have to do a little bit of work on legislatively together, but I believe that Secretary Jacobo also indicated that that is something that, you know, that could occur as well.
I hate to ask this question, but is it possible that some of these foster parents deliberately take kids into their homes for illicit purposes?
Well, I can tell you that 99% of the time, and it may be a much higher statistic than that, we don't have measurements. You've got great foster parents out there. I can tell you that we have seen examples, horrible examples, where foster parents have sexually abused and raped foster children. I was involved in a case yesterday where a 13-year-old girl was raped repeatedly over several years by a foster father. Those are by far the exception. There wasn't, you know, the kind of clear record with this foster family. This child, by the way, did not receive a comprehensive behavioral health assessment after she had been there was a great suspicion of sexual abuse beforehand, and she never got any therapy. She fell through a crack between DCF and private providers.
How can that be prevented, Gilda Ferraraz?
Well, I think, like Howard said, most foster parents are in it for the right reasons. Most foster parents...
I'm sure they are.
Yeah, I believe that most foster parents are in it for the right reason, and most foster parents are committed to providing the best care they can for their children. What we're trying to concentrate on is, in addition to making sure we have the right foster parents in place, and any foster parents that are not adequate are no longer foster parents, we're also working on supporting our foster parents more, through more training, more support services wrapped around the home. Some of these are children come from very difficult situations and may have special needs as the foster parent may not be fully equipped to handle. So we're trying to equip the foster parents better.
You also have no or very little influence over relatives or friends that enter the home.
Well, when we do a home study on prospective foster parents, we do explore all of that, up to whatever information we're able to gather. But we do gather information about frequent visitors to the home, about other family members who may maybe provide respite care for the children when the parents go out, and so forth. So we do try to do a pretty comprehensive assessment of the home situation. That doesn't mean that we're going to capture every single person who will ever come into that home.
Let's take a phone call or two from listeners. This is Walter. He's in Hollywood. Hi there.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for this great show, and thank you to your guests. I'm the supervising attorney of a children's advocacy program at Legal Aid Service in Broward County, and I would agree with Mr. Talenfeld's comments that really we need to not lose the oversight, the quality assurance that we have. There was a great town, tri-county delegation. Our legislative delegation met on August 20th, and we heard there that caseworkers are overworked. Caseworkers, the frontline workers, are often overworked. They're exhausted. They're not paid enough, and there's not enough support for them. So I think the analogy is I look around and I see our roads and great physical infrastructure being developed, and how many of us would drive across a bridge if we came to a sign that said 5 miles ahead there's a bridge, and it's been built with exhausted construction workers, and the quality assurance engineers have been taken out in large numbers, would we still drive across that bridge? And we're talking about our human infrastructure, and I think we need to give it the, not even the same, we need to give it the greater greater funding and support.
Okay, thanks.
And I would also support that children need to be heard.
And we'll move along to Andrew. He's in Hallandale. Hi.
Hey, Joseph. I was a guardian ad litem when I lived in Miami, and when a child needed to be pulled out of a home or made allegations of abuse, even in a foster home, DCF, the DCF caseworker, more often than not, just didn't react. And it usually took going to the judge in a case, like the next court date, to demand that DCF would finally take some action. So I was wondering if that's because there aren't any vacancies available, like they don't know where to put the child, and who's privy to that? How many foster homes are there in any county at a particular time? Who knows how many vacancies are available at the time? And are the homes ranked? Like, are they rated? Is there a rating system for quality and care? And from my experience, I don't think that even the judges are privy to that information. Only the caseworker perhaps is. So my question is, who is privy to that kind of information? And is there a way to be aware of the quality and reputation of each available home?
Ms. Faradaz, can you answer that?
Let me try to touch on each point that he's made. We actually have an excess of foster home beds available.
If you just look
at the raw numbers, we actually have empty foster home beds. However, that being said, it's sort of misleading because there are some foster parents that prefer one type of child over another. Maybe they prefer a younger child over an older child and so forth. So there may be some foster parents who say, yeah, I want to be a foster parent, but, you know, I'm not able to take a teenager or, you know, that kind of thing. So there is a matching system that the community-based care agencies have to determine what placements are available and for the particular child. So even if we look, I have seen reports, and I have available reports to me that show me how many, you know, foster homes are available, how many are empty, how many are filled, and all of that. But that being
privy
said,
to that information.
Pardon?
He wants to know who else knows about this. Can the judges see your list as well?
The judges, they could if they wanted to. I'm not sure that they would, you know, normally get that information. The judges
normally they just go on your recommendation,
right? Well, they
or the guardian ad litem.
Yeah, right. They basically determine the type of placement, so whether a child should be placed in a foster home or with a relative or stay at home or whatever. They don't actually get involved in the actual placement decisions as to which foster home and that type of thing. That's more the community-based care agencies. Now, we do have licensing standards for all of our foster homes, and there's, you know, relicensing and licensing inspections and all of that. I don't think we have a rating system like the gentleman is asking. Although it's probably, if you spoke with some of the workers, they'd be able to tell you, you know, which ones they like better than another.
Do the kids ever come to you and say there's something creepy about this house, I want out?
They could. We actually do investigations whenever we get a complaint about a home. We have a unit that does investigations. Part of our investigative child protective investigation unit that go out and investigate any allegations in foster homes. The foster homes are under this the community-based care agency, we do investigate them when we get complaints.
We're just about out of time. I certainly want to thank Howard Talenfeld, the founding president of Florida's Children First. Also, we've been speaking with the interim regional managing director of the Department of Children and Families of the Southern Region. She's Gilda Faradaz. Thank you both very much for addressing this most important topic.
Thank you.
And thank you for having us.
Food and Dining is next.
And you are listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. We're also streaming online. That address is WLRN.org. Thanks for joining us. We're funded by listeners like you and by GEICO, offering a variety of insurance products, including auto, renters, and motorcycle. More at GEICO.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
Sunday Afternoons of Music present cellist Joshua Roman and pianist Corey Smythe this Sunday, 4 p.m. at Gussman Concert Hall, University of Miami. Before embarking on his solo career, Roman spent two seasons as principal cellist of the Seattle Symphony. The San Francisco Chronicle describes Smythe as a keyboard wizard, dazzling. Their program includes works by Stravinsky, Prokofiev, and Schumann. Tickets at 305-271-7150 or sundaymusicals.org.
And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Well, our Food and Dining Thursday is here. I'm joined by my friend, chef, author, syndicated columnist, and producer, Linda Gassenheimer. Linda, we have a Food Network celebrity with us today.
We sure do.
We have lunch that you made.
We sure do. Mm, and you gobbled it up already. I know that. So, not only is she a celebrity, she's a rock star. She cooks like a rock star. So the question is, can we all be a top chef in our own kitchens? And our guest today says absolutely yes. Her TV shows are Secrets of a Restaurant Chef and Worst Cook in America.
I could be on that.
I'm sure you could. She's Anne Burrell, and she's here to give us some tips so we can all shine in the kitchen. Welcome, Anne Burrell.
Hi, everybody. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Great. Nice to have you with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
And also with us, with his usual smile, is Fred Tasker. He's the wine columnist for the Miami Herald, and he writes the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column in the Herald, and you can read that in the Herald today. Fred, are we drinking today?
Oh, we're always drinking. I'm going to talk about a wonderful wine called Malbec. And Anne, welcome to the show. I was telling Linda I was happy she got you because you always are so enthusiastic in your program.
Oh, well, thank you. And I have to say, I like someone who says we're drinking every day. That's the way I roll, too.
Okay. Cooking like a rock star. So how did you get the name rock star? I just love it.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people think that it starts with my hair. That's not true. That's not where I got it from. But it's more like, if everyone's saying that chefs are the new rock stars these days, I want everyone to be a rock star in their own kitchen. It's about empowerment.
Okay.
Making the process of dinner as fun as dinner.
Okay. So this is radio. So now you've talked about your hair. Let's describe it.
I would say it's a shock of spiky blondness.
a shock.
Love it, actually.
Her hair,
it's great.
Yeah, spiky blondness. It's spiky all over.
Spiky blondness, exactly.
So she's a spiky rock star.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a spiky blonde hair, and it's actually a little disconcerting when people come up to me all the time and ask me if they can touch my hair. And at least it's better than sometimes people come up to me and just touch it without asking, and that gets a little weird. But no, it's spiky blonde hair. I mean, you know, I'm all about the product.
I always wanted to do that, but my daughter won't let me.
Spike your hair?
Yeah.
Usually it goes the other way around, right? Doesn't the daughter want to do it and the dad says no?
Well, yeah, but, you know, times are different now.
Right, okay.
Okay, so Anne Burrell, you worked in top restaurants in Italy and New York, and you're Mario Batali's sous chef on Top Chef. On Iron Chef, thank you. And so help us become a rock star. What are some general cooking tips?
Well, some general cooking tips, and you know what? This, like, it doesn't seem very rock star like, but it goes a long way in making you a rock star. And it's funny because I always had problems with these when I was a young cook, or you know, like when I was a kid cooking. And you know, it's the low tech solutions. It's read your recipe before you start. Make sure you have all the ingredients, get them out, and do all your prep work or your mise en place before you start, so you can clean as you go, and then it makes cooking a whole lot more fun and a lot less stressful.
Well, that's some good tips. So what are big pitfalls that people have?
Well, a lot of people, you know, like they don't read the recipe, so they don't understand sort of where they're going from start to finish. And, you know, we've all had that experience where you say, like, okay, you get to the point in the recipe and it says add the remaining flour, and you're like, what remaining flour? Yeah. I added it all back, you know, that kind of stuff.
So when all else fails, read the instructions.
Yes, you know, or if you're not sure how to do something, like maybe check some reference material, like a recipe, you know. And I mean, that is, it happens a lot on Worst Cooks, on my show, Worst Cooks, and it shocks me how people know that they don't know how to cook, and they know that they're bad cooks, but yet they refuse to consult a recipe. I'm like, if you know you don't know how to do something, wouldn't you go read some instructions? And they just feel like they can wing it, and that's where things go wrong. And also, you know, the other thing is, like, you know, make sure you have everything. It's another, like, low-tech solutions. Like, we get to the point where it's like, okay, I need 2 cups of breadcrumbs, and you open up your breadcrumb canister, and there's, like, you know, a quarter of a cup in there, and then you're like, I wonder if I can substitute bread here. You know, that's when creativity comes into play, and sometimes things don't work out exactly the way you want them.
So you talked about Worst Chef, Worst Cook. This program is amazing. So how do you find the people, first of all?
They come to us. It is shocking how many people are like, how can I get on the show? And how many people show up at the castings for it. I mean, like hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of people come.
Some people may not have seen the show. So tell us what it's all about.
So it's, first of all, it's on Sunday nights at 9 o'clock on the Food Network. And this is our third season going into it. And this season I am pitted against the big gun at the Food Network, Bobby Flay. So Bobby and I each have a team of hopelessly bad home cooks, like horrendously bad home cooks. I like to call them our lovable losers. And we put them through a series of challenges. And one person from each team gets sent home after every challenge. Or on every episode, and then we're each left with one recruit, as we call them, and they cook a three-course meal for a panel of, like, chefs or food critics or, you know, culinary experts, and those people decide who the winner is. The winner wins $25,000, but what I like to say, more importantly, is it is a competition between myself and Bobby to see who is the better teacher.
Well, does someone get sent home because they're too good or because they're too bad?
Oh, no, definitely because they're too bad.
Oh, you know, I see. Okay.
It's they start
so
off
So you want
really
the best
bad.
Of the worst.
Yes,
so
exactly.
So what's the worst concoction they've come up with?
Oh, it's amazing what people do with cans of tuna fish.
Ooh.
I have never known so many or seen so many poor uses of a can of tuna fish in my life. And I'm like, I never knew people had such an affection for tuna fish.
Tuna and Campbell's soup.
Yes, you know, like, it's just, it's shocking what people do. And it, it, 5 minutes into the first round of cooking in the season, Bobby looked at me and said, "Are you kidding me?" Like, he was not even prepared for it, and I tried to prepare him. But every season, I think that I'm going to be prepared for it, and I guess, you know how, like, time heals all wounds, and, like, my eyes forget how bad the horrible things that I've seen happen to food.
Okay, so,
and every season, it comes back, and I'm like, oh, man, here I am again.
Okay, so what happens is that you're against Bobby. Now, the last two seasons, you've come up as the best teacher.
I have come up the winner, yes. So
yeah,
I'm
so
looking
for
my third win here.
All right, so we'll all have to root for you.
Yes, please do. Please do. Yay.
All right, we've got several phone calls here. Let's go to Joe in Miami. Hi, Joe. You're on the air. Joe, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I'd like to ask a question about a fish called Bronzino. It's a fish that I had up in a restaurant in Boca Raton, and I noticed that they're now selling it in markets here in Miami. Lorenzo's is one. And I'd like to know just basically how do you prepare that. In the restaurant, I think it was far roasted, and it was absolutely delicious.
Okay, so let's let Anne try and answer this question.
Okay, well, Branzino is a Mediterranean fish, and it's really delicious. It's along the lines of a sea bass. One of the most popular ways you see them is to see it roasted whole. So, I mean, that to me is one of the easiest and almost foolproof ways to do a fish. And usually one fish is a portion for one person. So what I like to do with it is, you know, just wash out the inside, stuff it full with some herbs and lemons, score the fillets on both sides, and toss it in the oven with, oil it up, salt it up. If you'd like to throw a few, really thin potato slices underneath with a little white wine and roast it, usually I say until the eyeball pops out.
It is a sea fish. It's not freshwater.
No, it's
salt
a Mediterranean.
Water.
Yes, it's a saltwater fish.
Well, I was kind of drooling until the eyeball part, but otherwise.
Yeah, I'm actually making a note of that. That's a very practical solution.
It's like the precursor to the pop-up turkey thing. I think that's where they. I think that's where they got the idea from. So, no, it's usually about, for a 1 1/4-pound fish, 20, 25 minutes, something like that.
Okay. Well, we have another caller here. We've got Tina in Boca Raton. Hello, Tina. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. Hi,
hello.
Tina.
Do you have a question, Tina?
I do. I'm a pretty decent cook, but it's been driving me crazy for a long time. I cannot bread with yeast. I either don't activate it or I kill it. It's just I can make everything else, but I cannot make bread with yeast. What would you suggest?
Buy it. No,
it's not the same.
I know, I'm teasing you. Well, first of all, you need to make, you need to activate your yeast and you need to feed your yeast. So yeast in warm water, not cold, not hot. So when you stick your finger in it, it should feel like comfortable and say, that feels nice and warm. And give your yeast some food. So you feed it some sugar and then let it hang out. And you can certainly tell if it's activated. So you will see it be very foamy. You'll smell it be very yeasty. And if that doesn't happen, start over.
Could
and make sure, buy your yeast fresh. Don't say, I've had this yeast in the fridge for a while.
Right.
Let me use that one.
Now, are you using dried yeast or the fresh?
Dried yeast, yes. And I even have a thermometer. And the last time I attempted, a sunflower bread, it said do the water, I think, was 100 degrees. And
that's
I measured
not quite
it.
Warm enough, I don't think. Do it a little bit warmer. I mean, you don't have to worry about a thermometer. Use your finger. Just stick your finger in it. And if it feels warm like a bath on your finger, you think about your own body temperature is 98.6 degrees, so it should be warmer than that. I'd say 105 or so.
Okay.
105 to 110, just a little bit warmer than your body temperature.
Well, good luck to you, Tina.
Thank you.
Also, I remember when I was in cooking school that they said, don't get salt anywhere near the yeast, that kills the yeast. All right, we're talking with Food Network star Anne Burrell. We're going to take a short break here, and we're going to be back with more.
And you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. I'm Caroline Brader-Watts. We'll be back to the program in just a moment. The Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau organizes Miami Spice in August and September. Close to 200 Miami Spice restaurants offer decadent three-course lunches and dinners, showcasing some of the best of Miami cuisine. You can experience signature dishes created by Miami's chefs and discover the tropical fusion of ingredients that make Miami dining so out of the ordinary. Details at ilovemiamispice.com.
I'm Peter Sagal. Public radio pledge drives are like golf shots or plates of escargot. Less is more, right? Well, starting later this month, WLRN begins a quest to cut back the number of pledge drives in the coming year, from 3 down to just 2. Get more of what you love about public radio and less of what you secretly loathe. From 3 down to 2, it all starts with you. Find out more at WLRNradio.org.
This week at O Cinema Miami Shores, New York Times critics pick Una Noche, a tale of a group of Cuban youth who flee Havana for Miami. Also screening, Pedro Almodovar's farce, I'm So Excited. Details at o-cinema.org.
Right now we're at Big Night in Little Haiti.
Big Night, Little Haiti.
We're enjoying the music at Big Night, Little Haiti.
You are listening to WLRN 91.3 FM.
Hi, I'm Michael Stock. Every Sunday on Folk and Acoustic Music, I bring you the best in contemporary and traditional bluegrass, blues, acoustic world music, and folk music. Plus, guests in the studio this week, Amy Carroll Webb, Rod McDonald, and Grant Livingston. The Public Storyteller is at 4 o'clock. Folk and Acoustic Music, Sunday, starting at 2.
And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and our guest is Food Network star Anne Burrell. Her show is The Secrets of the Restaurant Chef, and she's also part of the show called Worst Cooks in America. And she's been giving us tips on how we can be a rock star in our own kitchens. But it's dinner in minutes time, and both Fred and Joe have already eaten their dinner.
Indeed, we
yes,
did.
We
their
have.
Lunch.
And we liked it. Well, that had some zing to it.
And some garlic.
Oh, all right. It's wok flash salt and pepper shrimp with lemony rice. I was interviewing one time the TV chef Ming Tsai, and he said to me that this was a traditional dish. And it uses unshelled shrimp because the unshelled shrimp, the shells have most of the flavor. So for this recipe, I use, you can buy easy peel shrimp, which makes life much easier for you, in the frozen section of the market. And when you're buying the shrimp, look for the green market label so you know that that shrimp is carefully and sustainably raised. So you soak the shrimp in some water while you prepare the other ingredients. And as Anne Burrell said, prepare your ingredients ahead of time. It makes life much easier, especially when you're wok cooking. And then I put some cornstarch, salt and pepper with the shrimp, toss it, heat a wok, and make sure that oil in the wok is really smoking. Cook the shrimp, add some ginger and some scallions, and just toss it around, and a little garlic as well. And you're done.
Four to five minutes.
You know, the black pepper is what makes it. It just really gives it that spicy flavor.
Brings it up. Okay, great. Well, the side dish, I just used some microwavable white rice and tossed it with some defrosted peas, a little lemon zest, and lemon juice. Now, that recipe is in today's Miami Herald. Or you can go to dinnerinminutes.com. It'll link you straight to the recipe. Also, please follow me on Twitter, at L. Gassenheimer. And Fred, your Twitter?
At Fred Tasker Miami.
Okay, and you have a Twitter?
I do. It's Chef Anne Burrell, at Chef Anne Burrell.
At Chef Anne Burrell. Two R's, two L's.
Yep, and Anne with an E, of course.
Okay. Well, let's go to our drinking man here. Fred, what are we drinking?
The drinking man, okay.
I like that.
Yeah. I try to live up to it.
Believe me. And he does.
Oh, I'm looking forward to meeting you then. I hope I get to see you in Miami.
Yeah, we'll get together. Well, I want to tell you about a really nice Malbec from Argentina. Malbecs are wonderful wines. They're very, no hard edges, just nice, consumer-friendly, that sort of thing. And the ones I'm talking about are from a winery in Argentina near Mendoza. It's called Gascon, G-A-S-C-O-N. And they have a regular one for $15, and the reserve is $25. So it's not a super expensive wine. And the secret of their winemaker, whose name is Ernesto Baida, spelled B-A-J-D-A, is to grow them way up in the mountains. He grows them a mile high up the side of the Andes. And his theory is this, that far up, the ozone layer is thinner, and the grapes get more radiation from the sun, so they grow thicker skins to protect themselves, just as we would get a suntan, or a sunburn maybe, to protect themselves. And if grapes have thicker skins, that's where you get the color and the flavor, because all of that is in the skin. So, and it seems to work. And he even says, he claims they have more antioxidants, so they're even better for you than a regular.
So you're wine. Trying to tell us that this is a health drink.
Yeah, this is a health drink, okay, and it'll make you live forever. Yeah, absolutely. Baida is actually a kind of an interesting guy. His boss, Ernesto Catena, who of the famous Argentine Catena wine family, is a big polo fan to the point that he built a polo field up by the winery. And when Baida was trying out for his job, he thought he would impress his boss by trying a little game of polo. Unfortunately, this guy is 220 pounds, and he's left-handed. And for starters, polo ponies are little bitty ponies, and they don't want somebody that big. And for some reason, I don't understand, if you're left-handed, you tend to hit the horse in the flanks with your mallet all the time. So he flunked the polo test, but he's really passing the wine test, because these are really good wines. They're both very, very deep purple, with aromas and flavors of black cherries and blueberries and mulberries and licorice and bitter chocolate. They're very complex. It's a perfect wine for a nice, comforting beef stew, or just if you are putting your feet up by the fireplace and having a couple of glasses of wine.
All right. That sounds good. Well, and we've got a lot of people on the waiting online here to ask you some questions. So let's go to Michael in Pembroke Pines. Hello, Michael. You're on the air.
Oh, man, one of my Food Network heroes, Ann Burrell.
Hi.
I made your focaccia bread a few times. It's a lot of fun, and it comes out great every time. But I need to ask you another. Question. Try putting together ciabatta. I make the spun rises, let it sit for about 12 hours. Then I add the other ingredients to it, let it rise. It rises and doubles. When I pour it out on the board, it's difficult to shape into that little loaf shape. And then when I put it in the oven, it seems to flatten out more as opposed to getting a little bit of a rise. Any thoughts?
Yes, I would, before you toss it in the oven, let it hang out a little after you work it, because, you know, what's happening when you let it rise is it's collecting air in there, you know, it's like the yeast is giving off its gas. So let it form it into the shape and then let it hang out for a little while in a warm spot before you toss it in the oven again. Give it a chance to have the yeast to do its thing again.
Very good. I have a personal question. Do you and Guy have the same hairdresser?
Guy Fieri?
I've never heard that one before.
Let's tell some people who don't know, I don't know who doesn't know Guy Fieri, but what's his hair look like?
Well, we have very similar hair. You know, he has spiky blonde hair as well. Mine's a bit more feminine, and I certainly don't have the goatee that he has. But yes, it's the spiky blondness is.
I was wondering about Lisa Simpson. Do you have any affinity with her?
Well, yes, that's who I did my hair after.
You did? I see. Okay.
Well, I'd like to know more about that, but we're out of time. It's been a very tasty week. Ann Burrell, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Hooray. I'll see you guys all in Miami.
All right. See you there.
Her Food Network show is The Secrets of a Restaurant Chef, or Worst Cook in America. Fred Tasker, wine columnist for the Miami Herald. Great advice, as always.
Always a pleasure.
I'm going to see if there's more of that shrimp left.
I'll fight you for it.
Let's get off
the air.
Well,
I think Fred's been after it, so I don't know about that.
Yeah, but Joe's closer to the door. It's not fair.
Okay, Joseph Cooper, you ate well today.
Indeed. And thanks for making Topical Currents part of your day. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical supervision by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Want to hear more? We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And now an all-showbiz calendar for September 5th. On this day in 1929, 84 years ago, comedian Bob Newhart is born in Oak Park, Illinois. His 1960 Button Down Mind album outsold both Elvis and the Sound of Music cast album. Newhart had three network sitcoms as well. And on this day in 1940, 73 years ago, the birth of sultry Raquel Welch in Chicago. Her birth name was Jo Raquel Tejada. She won a Miss Photogenic Beauty title at age 14 and was perfect for Mother Jugs and Speed and Naked Gun. One more while we remember America's oldest teenager. On this day in 1987, 26 years ago, Dick Clark's American Bandstand is canceled after a 30-year run. Dick Clark died in April of 2012. His older brother was killed in World War II's Battle of the Bulge. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. So we leave with a thought from Bob Newhart, who once clerked at an unemployment office. He has a sister who's a nun. Quote from Newhart, "I don't like country music, but I don't mean to denigrate those who do. And for those people who like country music, denigrate means put down." This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Next, get into the here and now from where else but NPR News.